interest on his legacy. For the most part, his music had little in common with the pared-down melody lines, the warm lyricism, the relaxed tempos and chamber music delicacy that characterized the cool jazz vocabulary. Schuller, for his part, evaluates Tristano as part of his study of the swing era, and though a case could be made linking the pianist to swing period musicians, such as Art Tatum and Mel Powell, this too remains an unsatisfying choice. Finally, one might see Tristano as a precursor of the later free jazz movement. All these supposed genealogies can point to some family likeness to justify their claims. However, to my ears, Tristano's closest allegiance was to none of these schools, but rather to the bebop movement. He shared its fascination with long melodic lines, its celebration of intensity, its refusal to compromise, and its imperative to experiment. Tristano's activities shortly after his move to New York in 1946 support this contention. His stellar trio sides for the Keynote label find him alternating between a block chord style built on dense harmonic structures and a more driving linear approach in a bop vein. These devices would serve as the bricks and mortar of Tristano's mature piano style, and his skill with them was unsurpassed. Many other pianists of the period, notably Milt Buckner and George Shearing, would be celebrated for their locked hands chordal style, but none would take it to the daring extremes that Tristano surveyed. It would be hard to find jazz piano recordings from the mid-1940s more drenched in dissonance, more harmonically out there than Atonement and I Can't Get Started from Tristano's 1946-47 keynote performances. His way of using elongated phrases was equally path-breaking. One hears strong hints of Powell and Parker in his melodic constructions, but Tristano was even more radical than his contemporaries in his phrasing across bar lines. The underlying 4-4 pulse is almost totally obliterated in these linear improvisations, hidden under arcane superstructures of melody and rhythm. These skills made Tristano an ideal bebop pianist, and on a few occasions he performed and recorded with such key modern jazz figures as Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Max Roach, and Fats Navarro. But for the most part, Tristano preferred to make music in the company of his students and disciples. Two of these, Lee Konitz and Warren Marsh, would come to be major jazz figures in their own right. In time, Konitz, like his teacher, would become associated with the cool school in modern jazz. But with the altoist, the connection is far more justified. Konitz participated in the influential Miles Davis' Birth of the Cool Sessions, and for many years affected a sweet tone and lyricism that one never heard in Tristano. The relationship between teacher and pupil was often strained, and after the early 1950s, the two players mostly went their separate ways, with Konitz serving for a time with the Stan Kenton Band, and subsequently leading his own combos. In later years, Konitz's playing took on a rougher edge, and the links with the cool style became less obvious. But his work invariably maintained an integrity and almost ritualistic dedication to the process of improvisation that few of his contemporaries could match. Tenor saxophonist Warren Marsh had already worked as a professional musician for several years before connecting with Tristano around 1947. A technically polished saxophonist with an expansive range, Marsh offered a limpid, smooth tone, at times making his tenor sound like a fraternal twin to Konitz's alto. Marsh's melodic conception, however, lingered closer to Tristano's cerebral remoteness, almost mathematical in its purity, and mostly eschewed the quasi-romanticism with which Konitz briefly flirted. Konitz and Marsh both rank among the most consistently creative improvisers of their generation, and were especially potent when in each other's company. Examples of this musical chemistry can be found not just on the sessions with Tristano, but also in other settings, for example their artful 1955 collaboration for the Atlantic label, and their stunning 1959 sessions with Bill Evans at the Half Note. Tristano's 1949 recordings with Konitz and Marsh include some of the most intriguing jazz performances of the period. His 1949 tracks with Konitz for the Prestige label are especially uncompromising. Charlie Parker once suggested that the essence of modern jazz improvisation came from using the higher intervals of the underlying chords. Tristano and Konitz take Parker at his word here, maybe too much so. It almost sounds as if they are avoiding the lower intervals on these tracks. As a result, this music risks giving listeners a queasy, ungrounded sensation, despite its lissome execution. Tristano's 1949 recordings for Capitol also approach musical vertigo at times, but the playing is more robust, especially in the aptly titled Wow. Intuition and digression from this period are the first recorded examples in the jazz idiom of completely free-form group improvisation. 4 years later, Tristano would again anticipate the later evolution of free jazz with his jarring atonal work, Descent into the Maelstrom. Although this savage assault on the keyboard could exert no direct influence on the late 1950s avant-garde, since it remained unreleased for over two decades. Even when he pursued more mainstream efforts, Tristano seemed doomed to get caught up in controversy and partisan jazz debates. His 1955 recordings of Lineup and Turkish Mambo for the Atlantic label employed overdubbing and tape manipulation. Critics complained that Tristano sped up the tape of Lineup, and the resulting brouhaha prevented many from hearing the riveting brilliance of the improvisation. Played at any speed, it stands out as one of the finest jazz piano performances of the era. In the aftermath, Tristano retreated even more deeply into seclusion. 7 years would lapse before his next Atlantic release, The New Tristano, with the pianist now offering unforgiving, untampered solo piano performances of the highest order, including his virtuosic workout on C Minor Complex. One could listen to all of Tristano's commercial recordings in a few hours. Much of his best work was captured on amateur recordings that, like Descent into the Maelstrom, were not issued for many years. Several of Tristano's outstanding performances with Lee Konitz, made in 1955 at the Sing Song Room of the Confucius Restaurant, were issued by Atlantic in 1956, but many other equally compelling tracks from this engagement were kept off the market until the 1970s. Other live sessions from The Half Note, Birdland, the UJPO Hall in Toronto, or Tristano's 1965 visit to Europe are seldom heard, but deserve consideration as vital parts of Tristano's legacy. In addition, the pianist made many recordings at home, and these too provide telling glimpses of a major musical mind that often saved its most creative moments for private consumption. All in all, these constitute an important body of work, rich with implications for the future of jazz. However, at the time of Lenny Tristano's death from a heart attack on November 18, 1978, only one of his records was in print, and that one available only as an import from Japan. The passing years have seen a renewed interest in Tristano's music and a greater availability of his recordings. But the posthumous reverence awarded to many other and lesser figures from the past has been granted to him in only the smallest doses. However, few jazz artists of his day embraced the tenets of modernism with greater fervor or anticipated the later evolution of the music with greater insight. These three stylists, Bud Powell, Thelonious Monk, Lenny Tristano, may have redefined the role of the piano in modern jazz, but their music was distinctly unsuitable for the mass market of the 1950s. The listeners who still enjoyed Count Basie or Duke Ellington found little sustenance in the dissonant harmonies of a Monk, the unrelenting energy of a Powell, the serpentine melody lines of a Tristano. It was left to other pianists, Oscar Peterson, Nat Cole, George Shearing, Ahmad Jamal, Dave Brubeck, Errol Garner, to develop a broader following for contemporary jazz piano. Despite their differences, these six keyboard artists were consummate performers, skilled at smoothing the rough edges of modern jazz piano and extending its appeal. Critics were often ill at ease with the success enjoyed by these crossover artists, but though occasional compromises may have been necessary to achieve this commercial viability, these pianists retained the respect and admiration of most jazz fans, and with good reason, except for Cole, who ultimately abandoned the world of jazz piano for an immensely successful career as a popular vocalist. These musicians mostly remained true to their jazz roots, and even their most popular crossover hits, Brubeck's Take Five, Jamal's Poinciana, Peterson's West Side Story, Garner's Concert by the Sea, also merited praise as first-rate creative works. Throughout his career, Oscar Peterson wore the heavy mantle of being cited as heir and successor to Art Tatum as the greatest virtuoso of modern jazz piano. This is a daunting and dubious honor, akin to being known as the fastest gunslinger in a town of trigger-happy rivals. But Peterson's command of the keyboard was beyond reproach and established him as the most famous among the handful of post-Tatum jazz players, including Phineas Newborn, Dorothy Donegan, Adam Mackiewicz, Friedrich Gulda, Jessica Williams, who successfully channeled the techniques of the concert hall into a mainstream jazz piano sound. Yet the comparisons with Tatum should stop there. Peterson's music only occasionally betrayed Tatum's thickly textured two-handed style, instead tending toward the forward-driving linear attack associated with Powell. And unlike either Tatum or Powell, Peterson gave highest priority to maintaining the rhythmic momentum of the music, what jazz players simply call swing. The Will to Swing was the name Gene Lees gave to his book on Oscar Peterson, and few titles could have been more apt. Peterson stood out as one of the hardest swinging pianists of his generation, and though his rhythmic phrasing may have lacked the subtlety of a Parker or Tristano, it possessed a visceral appeal that only the stodgiest critics could deny. Peterson had established a modest reputation in his native Montreal before being discovered by Norman Granz in 1949. That same year, Granz featured Peterson at a much-publicized Carnegie Hall concert, and the impresario continued to play an important role in guiding Peterson's career in later years. Peterson served as an unofficial house pianist for Granz's various record companies and concert promotions, and in that capacity accompanied many of the leading jazz players who were active in the post-war years, including Louis Armstrong, Charlie Parker, Lester Young, Billie Holiday, Count Basie, Dizzy Gillespie, Stan Getz, Ben Webster, Ella Fitzgerald, and Benny Carter. Yet Peterson, unlike Tatum, could be a surprisingly self-effacing accompanist, and his best work typically came when leading his own trio or working as a solo pianist. His The Trio recording for Pablo, Night Train for Verve, and My Favorite Instrument for MPS are excellent, representative recordings of his music. Peterson also occasionally attempted extended works, the best known of which is his Canadiana Suite. Peterson maintained his popularity through the various revolutions and passing fashions of the jazz scene, and though a 1993 stroke compromised the agility of his left hand, he returned to the keyboard after a two-year hiatus and continued performing until shortly before his death in 2007. Despite the frequent comparisons with Tatum, Peterson's piano style suggests an even greater debt to Nat King Cole. Cole's appealing work as a vocalist eventually came to overshadow his prowess as a jazz pianist, but during the 1940s and 1950s, his keyboard approach was widely admired and emulated on the jazz scene. Like Peterson, Cole embraced a style that represented a middle ground between swing and bop. His intricate improvised lines, rapid-fire runs, and right-hand-oriented attack were in keeping with the dominant piano style of the post-war years. But Cole's sense of phrasing remained rooted in the ground beat, and at times looked back to the earlier style of Earl Hines, to whom Cole had closely listened during his formative years in Chicago. In essence, Cole preferred to dance comfortably over the beat, rather than challenge it head-on in the manner of Powell or Monk. This sense of relaxed swing was furthered by Cole's decision to lead a drummerless trio featuring piano, bass, and guitar. In his trio performances, as well as in his memorable recordings with Lester Young and his work with Norman Granz's various Jazz at the Philharmonic touring bands, Cole established himself as one of the most polished jazz pianists of the day. His incomparable singing, promoted almost to the exclusion of his piano work in later years, veered increasingly outside the jazz realm, but still revealed an exemplary sense of phrasing and clarity of expression with roots in Cole's keyboard approach. London-born George Shearing emigrated to the United States in 1947 at the height of the bebop movement. At his best, Shearing raises praise as an inventive, technically adept pianist with a keen ear and sure sense of swing. However, Shearing's most popular recordings found him leading a quintet where his ambitions were modest. In this setting, he tended to favor a pared-down style employing block chords, reminiscent of Milt Buckner, or at times, of a keyboard translation of the sound of the Glenn Miller saxophone section. Vibraphone and guitar were typically used to reinforce the melody line. The resulting Shearing sound, as it came to be known, was tasteful and inoffensive, but hardly measured the full depth of the pianist's talent. There were, in fact, many Shearing sounds. In time, he proved capable of playing classical concertos with symphony orchestras, or of creating his own orchestral sounds as a solo pianist, sometimes letting loose with stunning impromptu variations, for example, reworking his piece Lullaby of Birdland, first in the style of Rachmaninoff, next a la Waller or Debussy, never flagging as he moved through the paces. Much of Shearing's most creative work was recorded after his 60th birthday, when he came across as especially effective in a duo setting, or in collaboration with vocalist Mel Torme. If musicians were evaluated on native talent and raw potential rather than on their actual body of recordings, Shearing would undoubtedly rank as one of the finest artists of his generation. As it stands, much of his recorded output only hints at the depth of his musicality. Shearing's contemporary, Earl Garner, also developed a wide following during the 1950s, reaching such heights of fame that in 1958, impresario Saul Hurock, a major force in concert music, made an unprecedented move into the jazz field to represent him. Of all the pianists discussed here, Garner displayed the loosest ties to the bebop idiom, despite having recorded and performed with Charlie Parker during Byrd's West Coast period. In fact, it is difficult to pigeonhole Garner as a member of any school. His style was deeply personal, sometimes cranky, never pedestrian. He fought against the constraints of the instrument, at times making the piano sound like a guitar with his trademark 4-to-a-bar strumming chords, or like a drum employing offbeat bombs in the manner of an Art Blakey, or even like a harp unleashing Liszian arpeggios accompanied by a counterpoint of grunts and groans from above. His introductions were pieces in themselves, likely to veer off in any number of directions before honing in on the song in question. His technique was formidable, but so unorthodox that few noticed how difficult his music actually was to perform. His dynamic range was unsurpassed, and nothing delighted him more than moving from a whisper to a roar, then back to a whisper. Just as impressive was his sense of time. In Zeno's Paradox, Garner could just as well have been the tortoise as mighty Achilles, given how skillfully he could lag several paces behind the beat with a lazy catch-as-catch-can swing, or charge ahead with all caution thrown to the wind. Garner was self-taught, who could have instructed him in this crazy quilt style, and unable to read music. This did little to deter him from a career in music. After all, nobody can hear you read, he was quick to explain. For his hands, Garner needed to make no apologies. They were said to span a 13th, hard to believe given his diminutive stature, and he could sign autographs with either the left or the right. Such ambidexterity also showed at the keyboard. He could play a totally different rhythm in each hand, Cy Johnson once marveled, and develop equally what he was doing in each hand. And few pianists knew better than Garner how to keep their 10 fingers gainfully employed. He is said to be responsible for over 1,000 recordings on around 70 labels. Given this massive discography, Garner's consistency, enthusiasm, and freshness of approach are especially impressive. His best-known works include his Fantasy on Frankie and Johnny, his pop song Misty, eventually immortalized in the noir movie Play Misty for Me, and his best-selling Columbia recording Concert by the Sea. Other Garner projects of note include his Paris Impressions, Afternoon of an Elf, and Magician. Despite the large audience he attracted during his lifetime, Garner has exerted little influence on players who came of age after his death in 1977. Yet this is their loss, since his recorded legacy is rich with implication, unhindered by the prosaic, and could serve as the basis for a sparkling and brazen style even today. Ahmad Jamal's sparse, ultra-cool pianism stands as the antithesis of Garner's rocking Rococo ruminations at the keyboard. And if Garner was a throwback to an earlier era, with his pre-bop rhythms and traditional sense of swing, Jamal was a harbinger of the future of jazz. His studied use of space influenced Miles Davis and anticipated the later work of Bill Evans. His understated approach led some to dismiss him as essentially a cocktail pianist with little jazz substance. Jamal's real instrument is not the piano at all, but his audience, quipped one jazz writer. Such comments reveal more about the state of jazz criticism during these years, deeply suspicious as it was of any musician who developed a wide following among the general public, than about Jamal's streamlined keyboard attack. In this instance, Jamal's cardinal sin was apparently the substantial success of his 1958 live recording at Chicago's Pershing Lounge, But Not For Me, which reached number 3 on the Billboard album chart and remained on the list for over 2 years. The song Poinciana, recorded at this engagement, would become Jamal's signature theme, and effectively conveys the trademark virtues of his sparse, vibrant keyboard attack. This may have been popular music, but its appeal was not achieved through slick commercialism, rather was driven by the singularity of Jamal's vision. Jamal is often praised for his use of silence, but this scarcely conveys the depth of his musicality. After all, the precedent of John Cage notwithstanding, how difficult is it to be silent at the keyboard? The charm of Jamal's music came rather from his ability to maintain the swing, emotional conviction, and mood of his music even when playing the fewest notes. He accomplished this through a mastery of volume and phrasing, outstanding tone control, an orchestral conception of the piano, and an unfailing instinct for how to shape a solo from beginning to end. Yet Jamal's choice of sidemen also figured into this equation. Drummer Vernell Fournier and bassist Israel Crosby were unsurpassed at swinging while retaining the most subdued dynamic level. Together with Jamal, they formed one of the most underappreciated rhythm sections of the 1950s. Jamal's later work found him in a variety of settings, sometimes experimenting with electronics or performing with string accompaniment. The quality of these efforts is mixed, but the best of them, typically those finding him at the acoustic piano in a small combo setting, are on par with his milestone recordings from the 1950s. While Jamal's But Not For Me was gracing the Billboard charts, Dave Brubeck was achieving even more dramatic popularity with his Time Out recording. Take 5, the Paul Desmond composition included on this album, achieved unprecedented sales for a modern jazz instrumental performance and did much to legitimize unusual time signatures. But this represented no sudden rise to fame for Brubeck. Rather, the building blocks of his success had been slowly put in place during the course of the prior decade. In the late 1940s, Brubeck started drawing attention for his advocacy of the new and unusual, initially through the work of his octet. This ensemble, which drew on the most progressive strains in both jazz and classical music, was formed during Brubeck's stint at Mills College, where he and many of his colleagues in the octet were studying with modernist composer Darius Milhaud. Subsequently, Brubeck broadened his following while leading a piano trio that mostly showcased his adventurous reworkings of jazz standards. But Brubeck's greatest popularity came with the formation of his quartet, where his thick harmonies and strident rhythms were set off by the smooth alto work of saxophonist Paul Desmond. The combo recorded a number of outstanding live performances for the Fantasy label, in which the dictates of modernism and melodicism were artfully balanced. In 1954, Brubeck left Fantasy for the Columbia label, and, that same year, his photo graced the cover of Time magazine. His gradual building of a mass-market audience and the growing polish of the quartet, aided by the addition of the exceptional drummer Joe Morello in 1956 and journeyman bassist Eugene Wright in 1958, to form what many considered the classic Brubeck quartet, set the stage for the Time Out success. The fame and enormous record sales that Brubeck enjoyed were all the more remarkable given the uncompromising nature of his piano work. His approach to the keyboard was almost totally purged of the sentimental and romantic trappings or the oh-so-hip funkiness that characterized most crossover hits. His chord voicings were dense and often dissonant. His touch at the piano was heavy and ponderous, anything but the cocktail bar tinkling fancied by the general public. His music tended to be rhythmically complex, but seldom broached the finger-popping swing of a Peterson or Garner. Only in his choice of repertoire, which was populist to an extreme with its mix of pop songs, show tunes, traditional music, indeed anything from Camptown Races to the Trolley Song might show up on a Brubeck album, did he make a deferential gesture to the tastes of the mass audience. But even these familiar songs were apt to take on an unfamiliar guise under Brubeck's hands. He may have put aside the 12-tone row in favor of T for Two, but by the time he had finished with the Vincent Yeoman standard, it could sound like Schoenberg had tampered with the sheet music. Almost all the popularizers of modern jazz piano discussed here felt a degree of hostility from the critics of their day. As previously mentioned, this was very much part of the ethos of the jazz world during the post-war years. Parker and his colleagues had permanently changed jazz into a counterculture movement, suspicious of mass-market acclaim, protective of its outsider status. A wide audience was now a sign of having sold out. The motivations behind this pervasive and persistent attitude among the jazz establishment are complex, no doubt ranging from the personal to the political, and a detailed analysis of its evolution could fill a lengthy monograph. Suffice it to say that, for whatever reason, the felicitous marriage of popular music and jazz, which reached its apotheosis in the swing era, was succeeded by a painful, often acrimonious divorce. Big bands in the modern era. Nowhere was this new separation more apparent than in the struggles faced by big bands in the post-war years. Working with an instrumentation and vocabulary formed during the period of jazz's greatest popularity, these large ensembles appear to be distinctly unsuited to lead the jazz idiom into the modern era. By the start of the 1950s, singers, many of them former vocalists with big bands, had taken center stage in the world of popular music. Instead of Ellington, Goodman, Shaw, Basie, and Miller, the pop charts were dominated by Frank Sinatra, Peggy Lee, Nat King Cole, Joe Stafford, Doris Day, and Perry Como. One era had ended, another had begun. It is not difficult to find reasons to explain this shift. The problems faced by the big band leaders after the late 1940s were legion. The costs of taking a large band on the road had grown prohibitively high. The general public's interest fell to new lows. Even jazz devotees wavered in their loyalty, increasingly showing a preference for smaller combos. An entertainment tax instituted in 1944, which levied a 30% surcharge on venues that allowed dancing, led to a decline in ballroom patronage. This created a wedge between jazz music and dance, which widened during the post-war years due, in part, to a shift in performance styles, with medium-tempo swing numbers gradually losing favor to a less danceable mix emphasizing very fast or very slow pieces. Meanwhile, a panoply of modern technologies and conveniences, television, high-fidelity sound, various newfangled appliances, seemingly conspired to keep Americans at home in the suburbs. The result was an inexorable decline in the role of dance halls and other big band venues. The contemporary jazz scene of the 1950s was abandoned to the outsiders, the bohemians and beatniks and the young, those who still frequented the urban clubs late at night. For this crowd, the big band was most often viewed as a dinosaur, the retrograde sound of a generation whose time had already passed. In the face of these daunting circumstances, a few leaders persisted in their efforts to bring the jazz big band into the modern age, to adapt it to the changed circumstances of the day. The most ambitious of these, a Stan Kenton or Sun Ra, sought nothing less than revitalizing the big band as the creative center of the modern jazz world. A noble but, alas, an almost impossible task, akin to reintroducing sackbuts and lutes into the symphony orchestra. But though these attempts did little to return large ensembles to a position of prominence in the jazz world, that is hardly likely to happen again, they nonetheless spurred the creation of a vital body of work, a music of artistry, which served also as a quixotic protest against the marginalization of the big band sound. Unlike the dinosaurs, the big bands avoided total extinction, but just barely. Reading press clippings about swing bands from the late 1940s and early 1950s is as uplifting as browsing through a stack of obituaries. There are mostly tombstones and eulogies, few cigars and celebrations. In December 1946 alone, 8 major big bands broke up. A host of name leaders, many still in the prime of their lives, took early retirement, changed careers, or retrenched. Artie Shaw, age 44, put away his clarinet case for good. Cab Calloway took to the stage to play Sportin' Life in Porgy and Bess, the character George Gershwin had based on the Heidi Ho Man some years before. The Dorsey brothers grew nostalgic, settled their fraternal feud, made a mostly fictional movie about their career, The Fabulous Dorseys, 1947, and soon took their act to television. Louis Armstrong fired his big band and returned to a small combo traditional jazz setting and convinced Earl Hines to do the same. Around the time of his 40th birthday, Benny Goodman effectively ended his career as a bandleader, restricting himself from that point on to sporadic appearances with ensembles hastily gathered for specific tours or concerts. Who knows how many big bands were working regularly in America during the peak years of the swing era? George Simon's book on the subject refers to several hundred by name, and this is, of course, only a partial roster. A typical issue of Downbeat circa 1940 might list some 800 ballrooms, hotels, theaters, and other venues featuring big band music. For a time, big band jazz seemed always within earshot in America's cities. Yet after the painful contraction of swing music, only a handful of major big band leaders from the war years, most notably Ellington, Basie, Herman, Kenton, and James, still kept the flame alive, and even these few survivors struggled. The challenge, as most bandleaders saw it, was to hold on to the past. But for the most committed ones, the goal was nothing less than to bring the big band into the future. A few daring visionaries looked to the world of contemporary classical music for inspiration. Serious composers, such as Igor Stravinsky, were brandished as symbolic figures, if not as actual role models, by the more progressive big band arrangers. Boyd Rayburn recorded a chart titled Boyd Meets Stravinsky, on which, despite the name, Stravinsky did not perform. George Russell responded with his 1949 piece, Bird in Igor's Yard. Shorty Rogers was also apparently on a first-name basis with the maestro. After all, the Russian composer reportedly based the hornwork in his Threni on Rogers' style, penning his song, Igor. In 1948, when jazz writer Leonard Feather gave a blindfold test to Charlie Parker, he mixed in Stravinsky's The Song of the Nightingale with recordings by Basie, Goodman, and Kenton. Parker immediately identified the composer, adding, "That's music at its best." But Woody Herman had already outdone all of these acolytes. He was actually approached by Stravinsky himself, who offered to write a chart for the band. But the resulting work, the Ebony Concerto, should have made it clear that the jazz world, despite all its deference to the more progressive currents in contemporary classical music, had very little in common with such rarefied styles of composition. The Ebony Concerto was a turgid work that made little attempt to tap the rhythmic vitality of jazz. Those seeking to bring big band jazz to a higher level would need to look elsewhere for inspiration. For the most part, they looked to bebop as the magical ingredient that would revitalize the big band. And though this would seem an easy and obvious formula to follow, few did it with any degree of success. As noted before, Earl Hines, Billy Eckstine, and Dizzy Gillespie all led big bands featuring world-class modern jazz players, but none of these celebrated units lasted more than a few years. Boyd Rayburn's ensemble made a similar attempt to marry progressive sounds with traditional swing-era instrumentation, but was scorned by major labels who thought its music too weird for dancers. A verdict all too well borne out by 1946 recordings of George Handy's charts, Dalvatore Sally, which served as the band's theme song, and Temptation, which, despite its name, fans found all too easy to resist. Critics and musicians were enthusiastic about Rayburn's work, but his big band finally shut down in 1949 without ever having achieved a substantial hit. Benny Goodman also embraced bop in a famous reversal, only a short while before he had asserted that the beboppers were not real musicians and were just faking. But by 1948 he was publicly praising the new style and featuring a number of modern jazz players in his band, including Wardell Gray and, for a brief stint, Fats Navarro. Yet the following year Goodman disbanded his bop unit, and by 1953 he was again bad-mouthing the movement, telling the New York Times, "What you hear in bop is a lot of noise." Among the major white big band leaders, Charlie Barnett was the first to draw on the emerging modern jazz style. The band's 1939 hit Cherokee would come to serve as an unofficial anthem of the bebop movement, although at the time Barnett's group stayed fairly close to the model set by Ellington and Basie. But by 1942, the band had taken on a more modern sound, streamlined and hard swinging, and incorporating many of the melodic devices of bebop. The arrangements of Andy Gibson and later Ralph Burns set a cutting-edge tone for the Barnett Band, which was furthered by the addition of pianist Dodo Marmarosa, bassist Oscar Pettiford, trumpeters Neil Hefti and Al Killian, and clarinetist Buddy DeFranco, among others. For a brief period, Barnett even had Dizzy Gillespie in the group. These were bold moves for a white bandleader, and not just from a musical standpoint given the rarity of integration in the ensembles of the day. Yet Barnett had long stood out as a champion of racial tolerance in the jazz world, indeed rivaling Goodman in this respect, with Roy Eldridge, Benny Carter, Lena Horne, Frankie Newton, and Charlie Shavers, among others, serving stints at various times with his band. These combined influences gave Barnett's group an authentic bop sound, this coming several months before Gillespie's combo brought modern jazz to 52nd Street. In fact, bop had hardly ventured beyond the doors of Minton's and Monroe's at the time that Barnett was presenting it to his audiences. Günther Schuller, in his masterful study, The Swing Era, has declared with some justification that with the band's October 1943 recording of The Moose, arranged by Burns and featuring 17-year-old Marmarosa in top form, modern big band jazz was born, or at least baptized. Barnett has long been dismissed as a white imitator of the leading black bands, but this ensemble was innovative by almost any measure. Even the old jazz pieces that Barnett revived during this period, such as his 1944 remakes of Ellington's Drop Me Off in Harlem and Armstrong's West End Blues, were presented in new garb, glistening bop-oriented versions as advanced as anything in the swing repertoire of the time. But Barnett, for all his virtues, struggled to retain the talent he discovered. Where his role model Ellington could hold on to key players for years, Barnett often kept them for only a few months. Despite this steady turnover, his bands continued to flourish for the remainder of the decade. The main beneficiary of Barnett's losses would prove to be Woody Herman, a bandleader with an unfailing knack for continually reinventing his sound. Herman's performing career had passed through virtually every style of popular music by the time he found himself leading a bop big band. Born in Milwaukee in 1913, Herman started performing at age 6, singing and dancing in his hometown, and went on the road for the first time at the age of 9. As a youngster, he played the vaudeville circuit, where he was billed as the boy wonder of the saxophone. The next phase of Herman's career found him plying his trade in society and sweet bands, most notably the Isham Jones Ensemble that Herman joined in 1934. When Jones disbanded in 1936, Herman drew on its members to form his own group, known for a time as the Band That Plays the Blues. The group also dabbled in other jazz styles, including Dixieland, and eventually gravitated toward swing numbers, such as the riff-based blues Woodchopper's Ball, which became Herman's first hit in 1939. Follow-up records such as Blues in the Night and Blue Flame also sold well, and by 1942 the Herman Band had established itself as one of the leading swing orchestras of the day. At this unlikely point in his career, Herman began deviating from the formula that had brought him success and, ever restless, gradually came to embrace the new bop idiom. Herman's evolution from sweet music to traditional jazz to modern jazz is almost unprecedented in the history of music. Few band leaders of his generation could consider such a wholesale change, and even fewer would have been capable of it. Yet when understood properly, this dramatic shift provides a telling insight into Herman's unusual, perhaps unique, relationship to his musical milieu. For Woody Herman is best understood not as a band leader or even as a musician, but as a catalyst. His talent lay not primarily in what he did, but in what he enabled others to do, spurring those around him to tap their deepest creative currents, inspiring them, letting them loose, so to speak. So much so that it is easy to lose sight of his own considerable skills as an instrumentalist and vocalist. Hence Phil Wilson's apt quip, "Nobody does what Woody does as well as Woody does. If we could only figure out what it is he does." With his sure instincts for recognizing talent, Herman quickly sought out the leading lights of the modern jazz movement. In 1942, he hired Dizzy Gillespie to write for the band. Some decades later, Gillespie introduced Herman to the crowd at the Monterey Jazz Festival as the first person ever to pay me $50 for an arrangement. And he brought a large number of enthusiastic young modern jazz players into his ensemble, many of them former members of Arnett's band. The rhythm section was galvanized by the addition of bassist Chubby Jackson, guitarist Billy Bauer, and hard-swinging drummer Dave Tuff. And in 1944, two musician-arrangers who had also worked with Barnett, pianist Ralph Burns and trumpeter Neil Hefti, joined the Exodus to the Herman Band and gave further momentum to its progressive leanings. The trumpet section included Sonny Berman, a masterful soloist who might have established himself as one of the leading brass players of his day had he not died before his 22nd birthday, as well as Pete Candoli, a fiery instrumentalist with a penchant for high-note dramatics. Two other 1944 additions to the band, trombonist Bill Harris and tenor saxophonist Flip Phillips, were outstanding improvisers and equally at home in either swing or bop settings. Harris's fresh approach to the trombone was so deeply personal that, in the words of pianist Lou Levy, it circumvented style. It wasn't bebop, it wasn't Dixieland, it was his own. Later additions to the First Herd, as this band came to be called, included vibraphonist Red Norvo, trumpeter Shorty Rogers, and pianist Jimmy Rolls. This was a rare breed of modern jazz ensemble. It drew on the most progressive currents in jazz, but did so without taking on the self-serious and aloof, at times pretentious demeanor that prevented many bop groups from gaining favor with the general public. Here again, Herman's savvy and people skills played an important role. Often cited as the name bandleader who was best liked by his musicians, Herman bred a high-spirited enthusiasm among his players, encouraged their often outré senses of humor, and added to their emotional commitment through a collective ownership arrangement rare in the music world. The bandleader's tolerant attitude was not without its costs. For one, drug and alcohol problems would bedevil the band for a time, but it also gave the Herman Herds a carefree attitude that audiences found engaging. The initial Herd, in particular, stood out not only as a pioneering band, but also as the most popular and financially profitable ensemble Herman would ever lead. The first Herman Herd was also one of the most versatile bands of its day. Its exuberance shines through in up-tempo recordings such as Apple Honey and Northwest Passage. At other times, the band might take an unabashedly romantic turn with dreamy renditions of Laura or Happiness is a Thing Called Joe. The group's comic side came to the fore in novelty vocals such as Caledonia, oddball instrumentals like Goosey Gander, or surprising mid-song twists such as Sonny Berman's bitonal interjections in Your Father's Mustache. It is hard to believe that this same loose, unrestrained band was the one Stravinsky selected to debut his Ebony Concerto, which quickly disappointed any listeners who had expected the Russian composer to embrace Herman's laissez-faire swing. Instead, the Herman Band was the party that had to adapt the most, doing their best to excite skeptical jazz audiences with Stravinsky's distinctly unswinging piece, surprisingly so given the rhythmic vitality of many of his other compositions. This was an infelicitous mixture, as even the composer soon learned, discovering that he needed to have the piece rescored so that the players could handle its unusual, for a jazz band, metrics. More idiomatic and popular with Herman's fans was Ralph Burns's extended work, Summer Sequence, a richly melodic piece performed by the band at Carnegie Hall alongside Stravinsky's composition. Other memorable efforts by this edition of the Herman Band include Burns's chart Bijou, once described by Herman as a Stone Age bossa nova, with a moving solo by Harris, Sidewalks of Cuba with its noteworthy Sonny Berman solo, and Hefti's musical conversation, here Phillips's give and take with a brass titled The Good Earth. The first herd came to a halt in December 1946. Both personnel and personal problems spurred Herman's decision to disband. Exhausted by a demanding schedule, troubled by his wife's substance addictions, and witnessing the departure of many key band members, only the previous month he had lost the core of his trumpet section when Berman, Candoli, and Rogers all left, Herman saw that the time had come for a hiatus from the road. But just 9 months later, he decided to regroup with a new band featuring a largely different crop of soloists. Matching the excitement level of the earlier herd, one of the most popular bands of the day, would have seemed an almost impossible task, and adding to the challenge was the inhospitable atmosphere for big bands in general during these post-war years. An end-of-an-era ethos permeated the music industry, and though almost a decade would pass before the electrified sounds of rock and roll would drown out the competition, it was clear to many that the old formulas no longer held sway. Herman confronted these obstacles head-on, and did so in the grand style, bringing together one of the strongest big bands of the decade, and capturing an entirely new sound in the process. The heart and soul of the second herd, or the Four Brothers Band, as it is often called, was centered in its sax section. The basic concept of the Four Brothers sound was simple enough. Its foundation was tight ensemble writing for three tenor saxophones and a baritone sax. But the key to this section work lay in the distinctive approach of the saxophonists in question. Adopting a light, airy tone reminiscent of Lester Young, and combining it with the melodic pyrotechnics of modern jazz, these horns mastered a novel formula, merging the excitement and intricacy of bop with a sweet-toned lyricism. Just a few years later, this mixture of modernism and melodicism would come to be known as cool jazz. A number of premier saxophonists would play in this section during the second herd's existence from 1947 to 1949, including Zoot Sims, Al Kahn, Herbie Stewart, Jimmy Giuffre, Serge Chaloff, and Gene Ammons. But the most celebrated soloist of the Four Brothers period would prove to be the youngest member of this group. Tenor saxophonist Stan Getz, barely out of his teens when he joined the Herman Band, had already served stints with Jack Teagarden, with whom he recorded when only 16 years old, Benny Goodman, and Stan Kenton. Born in Philadelphia on February 2, 1927, Getz spent most of his early years in the Bronx, where his father worked as a printer. A precocious talent, Getz dabbled at a variety of instruments, including harmonica, string bass, and bassoon, before settling on saxophone. He finished only 1 year of high school, but already had earned a spot on the coveted All-New York City High School Orchestra as a bassoonist, and his school conductor predicted that a scholarship to Juilliard lay in his future. Instead, Getz ventured on the road at age 15 with Teagarden, who eventually had to sign guardianship papers to keep his underage saxophonist. Other high-profile gigs followed, but Getz showed little inclination for staying in one place for very long. He left Kenton after the bandleader made disparaging remarks about Getz's idol, Lester Young, then stayed for a brief period with the Jimmy Dorsey Band before joining Goodman, who reportedly fired him. All this while Getz was still a teenager. The Herman Association, although it too ended after only a few months, would prove to be a turning point for Getz. Two other future Herman saxophonists played a central role in setting the stage for Getz's eventual stardom. Herbie Stewart encouraged Getz to adopt the lighter, Lester Young-inflected tone and relaxed phrasing that would eventually become his trademark. Jimmy Giuffre would help popularize the Four Brothers sound, learned from arranger Gene Roland while he and Getz were working in Tommy DiCarlo's band in Los Angeles. When Herman hired Giuffre, first as an arranger, later as a saxophonist, and Getz, he also brought on board the new sound. Giuffre's Four Brothers chart served as a spectacular showpiece for the saxophone section's novel approach. Even more important for Getz was his hauntingly delicate solo on Ralph Burns's Early Autumn, adapted from Summer Sequence, Part 4, the recently added epilogue to the composer's popular Summer Sequence. Getz had already left the band by the time this recording was released, but its popularity created a receptive audience for his ensuing work as a small combo leader. But Getz, despite his renown, was far from the only major saxophonist in Herman's second herd. Another Lester Young disciple, Al Kahn, joined the band shortly after the Four Brothers recording. Kahn had little opportunity to solo with the Herman Orchestra during this period, but in time would establish himself as an inventive tenor saxophonist and a talented composer. Zoot Sims, who worked with Kahn both in the Herman Band and in a later long-lived two-saxophone combo, also showed an allegiance to Young, enriched by Sims's unflagging sense of swing and impeccable taste. Jimmy Giuffre may have been a less distinguished soloist than these peers at the time of the second herd, but his later career demonstrated the most pronounced evolution of any member of the group. He worked for a time with the Lighthouse All-Stars and Shorty Rogers' Giants in California, where he became a leading exponent of West Coast jazz, later released a series of eclectic, intensely creative recordings for the Atlantic and Verb labels, and, by the close of the 1950s, had embraced atonality, a progression that none of the other brothers, a conservative fraternity when it came to musical values, could match. Gene Ammons' stint with the Herman Band would be brief, but in time he too would come to establish himself as a major player, popularizing the soul jazz idiom with a style that drew heavily on blues and gospel roots. Serge Chaloff showed the deepest allegiance to bop among the Herman saxophonists and earned praise for his skill in adapting many of Charlie Parker's innovations to the baritone. Ill health aggravated by drug addiction would sideline Chaloff for much of the 1950s, and at his death in 1957, he was only 33 years old. But his work with Herman, as well as his various recordings in smaller combos, reveal an expressive, technically accomplished instrumentalist. But this was more than just a band of up-and-coming saxophonists. The second herd also benefited from the eventual return of Bill Harris to the band, the maturing of Shorty Rogers, who blossomed into an excellent composer during this period, and the contributions of a number of new composer-arrangers, including Giuffre, Kahn, and Johnny Mandel. Herman disbanded the second herd in late 1949. Although the ensemble had enjoyed great popularity with jazz fans, Downbeat readers chose it as their favorite big band that year, with Herman outpolling the second-place Ellington group by a 3-1 margin, it had been a financial disaster. After taking a small combo to Cuba, Herman formed a third herd in the spring of 1950. Many earlier Herman associates were hired, along with new faces such as pianist Dave McKenna and drummer Sonny Igo. Despite the various challenges in his way, including a major reshuffling of the band's personnel at the end of 1955, Herman continued to work steadily throughout the decade. But the jazz world changed dramatically during these years, as did the tastes of the general public. In the context of a transformed music scene, one that included Ornette Coleman, Elvis Presley, Cecil Taylor, Jerry Lee Lewis, John Coltrane, Little Richard, and Muddy Waters, Woody Herman could no longer demand respect as a major force at the cutting edge. By the close of the 1950s, Herman was working frequently with a small combo. He would come to regroup, a Herman trademark, and though some of the herds of later years made outstanding music, for example the powerhouse 1962-65 unit, dubbed the Renaissance Herd by Herb Wong, they failed to match the renown Herman enjoyed during his glory decade from 1945 to 1955. Herman would stay on the road almost to the end of his life, playing Carnegie Hall and high school assembly halls with equal enthusiasm. With even greater persistence, he was pursued by government tax authorities, who claimed violations dating back over 20 years, due to lapses for which Herman's manager, not the bandleader himself, was responsible. In later days, Herman's financial situation was always precarious, with medical expenses adding to the daunting debt owed to the Internal Revenue Service. A few days before his death in October 1987, the ailing Herman was served an eviction notice dismissing him from his Hollywood home. Only a groundswell of grassroots support and donations from friends, fans, and former sidemen, including a bill debated in Congress to wipe out Herman's tax liabilities, prevented an ignominious end for this important contributor to American music. For most of this period, Stan Kenton stood out as Herman's greatest rival in creating an unabashedly progressive jazz big band. These two figures are often mentioned in the same breath, and, true, the similarities between the bandleaders are striking. Both were swing-era veterans from Middle America who came of age at the dawn of the Great Depression and converted to modern jazz at the close of the war years. But these overlapping biographical facts are merely superficial. The contrasts are overwhelming. The affable Herman, genial and permissive, let his bands discover their own musical identity. The strong-willed Kenton, in contrast, forged an orchestra in his own image, as massive as his 6.5-foot-tall frame, as expansive as his personal aspirations, as varied as his moods. Herman had a knack for making modern jazz palatable for the mass market, and would not hesitate to record trite novelty songs to capture the public's approval. "I think it's very important to reach that other audience, the larger audience," Herman once explained. "The guys in the band and I put in a good day's work over 300 days a year. We deserve a payoff sometime." Kenton, in contrast, disdained such compromises, although he was not entirely above them, driven instead by a need to create important music, jazz music on a larger scale than anyone had envisioned before. Eventually, he established his own corporation and record company, Creative World, to escape the commercial pressures of the music industry. While Herman's modernism drew inspiration from bebop, Kenton avoided the term with a vengeance. Instead, he continually invented new names for modern jazz. He delighted in describing it as progressive jazz, or in featuring his 1950 band, which included a full string section, under the rubric of Innovations in Modern Music, or in dubbing the 1952 edition New Concepts in Artistry and Rhythm. Eventually, he coined his own word, neophonic music, deriving from Greek roots meaning new sounds. Not that Kenton was against bebop, he simply preferred to pretend that it did not exist. His brand of modern jazz was all that mattered. Stan Kenton was born in Wichita, Kansas on December 15, 1911, but spent much of his childhood in California. He dabbled at string, brass, and reed instruments before focusing his energies on arranging and the piano. He apprenticed in a wide range of groups during his 20s, eventually passing up more lucrative opportunities to perform his own music with a Southern California rehearsal band. Through sheer persistence, Kenton managed to secure a few local gigs, and eventually parlayed them into an extended engagement during the summer of 1941 at the Rendezvous Ballroom on Balboa, an island retreat catering to a young clientele. Kenton's band was just as young, perhaps younger. Only two sidemen were over the age of 21, and the audience responded with unprecedented fervor to this little-known group of post-adolescents, with horns conducted by the statuesque man with a frenzied demeanor, swinging arms and unceasing motion. The Kenton Band soon signed with a Decca label, began performing at the largest ballrooms in the country, and was written up in almost every issue of Downbeat. Kenton had started his orchestra as a way of featuring his own compositions, sweeping themes such as Artistry in Rhythm, more indebted to Tchaikovsky and Romberg than to any jazz forebears. But in time, Kenton realized that his genius lay in creating an environment in which other musical minds could refine and expand the Kenton sound. He had a taste for combining the most disparate elements, as in his post-war band, in which the hypermodern compositions of Pete Rugolo were leavened with the bittersweet alto sax of Art Pepper and the conversational girl-next-door vocal style of June Christie. For a time, Rugolo served as Kenton's alter ego, writing or collaborating on a series of ambitious pieces, some jazzy, others with an Afro-Cuban influence, many of them classically tinged. But before long, Kenton was again broadening his scope, drawing on other composers in residence. At the same time, he was expanding his musical palette, experimenting with new instruments and different textures. True, there was a trademark Kenton sound, brassy, extroverted, pseudo-symphonic, grandiloquent, but Kenton also delighted in undermining this very style by hiring writers and soloists with contrasting musical perspectives. Bill Holman's smoothly swinging charts with echoes of Kansas City jazz were very much beloved by the band's soloists, and he returned the favor by supplying some of the most memorable feature numbers in the band's history. Cherokee, a chart originally penned for Charlie Parker but taken over with authority by Lenny Niehaus. The more moody Yesterdays, which evokes a Lester Young strain from tenorist Bill Perkins. Stella by Starlight, which takes altoist Charlie Mariano through ballad and double-time paces. There is little wasted motion in these arrangements, none of the excesses that weigh down many Kenton band charts. but Holman was capable of more daring reworkings of traditional material, as his deconstructions of What's New, Stompin' at the Savoy, and I've Got You Under My Skin make eminently clear. Bill Russo's writing for the band, in contrast, was more firmly rooted in the Kenton Rugolo tradition. His Halls of Brass pushed Kenton's horn obsession to an extreme in a virtuosic exercise that reportedly garnered begrudging admiration from symphony brass sections. But Russo also harbored a more introspective side, betrayed on his finely shaded version of There's a Small Hotel, or the plaintive romanticism of Solitaire. Other writers also contributed richly stylized charts, further defying the notion that there was a single Kenton sound. Johnny Richards' Cuban Fire arrangements demand respect as among the most powerful and successful explorations of Latin music in a jazz context. Jerry Mulligan's writing for Kenton bespoke a relaxed swing and intimacy in tune with a baritone saxophonist's cool aesthetic. Bob Gredinger's contributions to the band's repertoire were at the other extreme. These dense, dissonant explorations, most notably his magnum opus, City of Glass, are exquisitely disturbing. No jazz composer of his day anticipated the later advent of free jazz with more gritty determination. Kenton's advocacy of Gredinger's distinctly unpopular music makes it clear how committed this bandleader was to pluralism and staying at the vanguard of big band jazz. But this was much more than a writer's band. Especially during its glory days of the 1940s and 1950s, the Kenton Orchestra was rich in star soloists. Art Pepper graced the band during the earliest days of his career, brandishing a before-the-fall innocence that is most notable on Shorty Rogers' eponymous feature piece for him. He went on to enjoy a substantial career as a leader in his own right, as did trumpeter Maynard Ferguson, who soon drew raves as the most celebrated high-note brass player of his generation. Frank Rosolino was equally admired as a virtuoso on the trombone and demonstrated his facility on such recordings as I Got It Bad and That Ain't Good and Frank Speaking. Crediting Rosolino for broadening the technique of the trombone in the 1950s, Bill Russo has recalled, "We were all staggered by what he could do, not only at the speed of his technique and that he played so well in the upper register, but that he had such incredible flexibility." Lee Konitz figured prominently in the Kenton lineup for a brief period in the 1950s and was featured soloist on a number of performances, including an ethereal rendition of Loverman that ranks as one of the altoist's finest recorded moments. Zoot Sims also served a short stint with Kenton and left behind a characteristically hard-swinging performance on Holman's chart, Zoot. Stan Kenton was not the only 1950s big band leader who attempted to remake modern jazz in his own iconoclastic image. Sun Ra drew on an equally eclectic mixture of forward-looking jazz styles in the various recordings made with his large ensemble, the Orchestra, a band invariably described by the leader with one or more impressive descriptives attached. For example, the Myth Science Orchestra or the Astro Infinity Orchestra. A certain extravagance permeated almost everything having to do with this artist. Many jazz players are guilty of distorting or exaggerating the facts of their early years, but only Sun Ra went so far as to trace his origins back to the planet Saturn and claim descent from a race of angels. In truth, Sun Ra was apparently born with the more pedestrian name of Herman Blount in Alabama in 1914. He came of age as a pianist and composer during the swing era and worked for a time in the late 1940s in the Fletcher Henderson Band. His visionary music, however, did not come into its own until the mid-1950s, when he began recording extensively with his large band, first in Chicago, and later in New York, Philadelphia, and other environs. Sun Ra's coterie of fans came to expect the unexpected and were seldom disappointed. The orchestra's lineup might include, on a given night, as few as 10 musicians or as many as 30. Dancers, costumes, slideshows, and other extras might be included with the price of admission. The orchestra's music could be equally changeable. Elements of bebop, hard bop, and swing loom large on the band's mid-1950s recordings. But over the next decade, the orchestra would embrace an even broader palette, swirling layers of percussion, spooky electronic effects, disjointed echoes of rhythm and blues, hints of Asian and African music, dissonance, atonality, at times aural anarchy. Sun Ra's jargon-laden talk of the cosmos and interplanetary music may have sounded like a half-baked script from a Cold War sci-fi movie, but his appetite for the new and anomalous truly spanned a universe, or at least several galaxies, of sounds. Much confusion has surrounded the dating of Sun Ra's various recordings. When the Impulse label purchased a number of tapes from him in the 1970s, they released old and new works side by side with little attention to chronology. And Sun Ra himself was equally lax. He would often sell his self-financed records, sometimes produced in quantities of less than 100 copies, at concert intermissions, during which confused fans could browse through boxes of unmarked, unlabeled LPs. But the incompleteness of our discographical information cannot hide the fact that Sun Ra had a knack for being years ahead of the jazz world. The free jazz explorations of Cosmic Tones for Mental Therapy, the world music and electronics of supersonic jazz, were pioneering efforts for their time. Sun Ra